The hyena was an old male. There were patches of fur missing from his thick, shaggy coat, and his flat, almost snake-like head was covered with scars, his ears ripped away by thorns, and 100 snapping, snarling encounters over the decomposing carcasses of men and animals. His lip had been torn up into the soft of the nostril in one of these fights, and had healed askew, so that the yellow teeth in one side of his upper jaw were exposed in a hideous grin. His teeth were worn with age, so that he could no longer crush the heavy bones that made up the bulk of hyena diet, and unable to compete, he had been driven from the hunting pack. There had been no human corpses along the trail since the slave column had passed weeks before, and game was scarce in this dry country. Since then, the hyena had subsisted on scrapings, the fresh dung of jackal and baboon, a nest of field mice, the long-abandoned and addled egg of an ostrich, which had burst in a sulphurous geyser of gas and putrefied liquid when he poured at it. However, even though the hyena was starving, he still stood almost 3 foot high at the shoulder and weighed 140 pounds. His belly, under the matted and scruffy coat, was concave as that of a greyhound. From high, ungainly shoulders, his spine slanted back in a bony ridge to his scraggy hindquarters. He carried his head low, snuffling at the earth for offal and scourings, but when the scent came down on the wind to him, he lifted his head on high and flared his deformed nostrils. There was the smell of wood smoke, of human presence, which he had grown to associate with a source of food. But sharper, clearer than all the others, was a smell that made the saliva run from his twisted, scarred jaws in drooling silver ropes. He went lolloping into a swaying, uneven trot up into the wind, following the tantalizing drift of that odor. The scent that had attracted the old dog hyena was the cloyingly sweet taint of a gangrenous leg. The hyena lay on the outskirts of the camp. It lay like a dog, with its chin on its front paws and its hind legs and its bushy tail drawn up under its belly, flat behind a clump of coarse elephant grass. It watched the activity about the smoking watchfires. Only its eyes rolled in their sockets, and the ragged stumps of its ears twitched and cocked to the cadence of human voices and the unexpected sounds of a bucket or an axe on a stump of firewood. Once, a puff of wind would bring a whiff of the scent that had first attracted the hyena, and it would snuffle at it, suppressing with difficulty the little anxious cries that rose in its throat. As the evening shadows thickened, a human figure, a half-naked black woman, left the camp and came towards its hiding place. The hyena gathered itself to fly, but before she reached the place where it lay, Juba paused and looked about her carefully, without seeing the animal. Then she lifted the flap of her beaded apron, lowering herself, and squatted. The hyena cringed and watched her. When she stood and returned to the camp, the creature, emboldened by the oncoming night, crept forward and wolfed down that which Juba had left. Its appetite was piqued, and as the night fell, it inflated its chest, curled its bushy tail up over its back, and uttered its drawn-out haunting cry, ascending sharply in key. Owee! Owee! A cry so familiar to every man and woman in the camp that hardly one of them bothered to look up. Gradually, the activity about the campfires subsided. The sound of human voices became drowsy and intermittent. The fires faded, the flames sinking, and the darkness crept in upon the camp. And the hyena crept in with it. Twice a sudden loud voice put it to trembling flight, and it galloped away into the bush, only to gather its courage at the renewed silence and creep back. It was long after midnight when the beast found a weak place in the protective scarum of thorn branches about the camp, and quietly, furtively, pushed its way through the opening. The smell led it directly to an open-sided thatched shelter in the centre of the enclosure, and with its belly low to the earth, the huge dog-like animal slunk closer and fearfully closer. Robin had fallen asleep beside her father's litter, still fully dressed and in a sitting position. She merely let her head fall forward onto her crossed arms, and then, overwhelmed by fatigue and worry and guilt, she at last succumbed. She awoke to the old man's shrill shrieks. There was complete darkness blanketing the camp, and Robin thought for a moment that she was blinded by a nightmare. She scrambled wildly to her feet, not certain where she was, and she stumbled over the litter. Her outflung arms brushed against something big and hairy, something that stank of death and excrement, a smell that blended sickeningly with the stench of her father's leg. She screamed also, and the animal growled, a muffled sound through clenched jaws, like a wolfhound with a bone. Fuller's shrieks and her screams had roused the camp, and somebody plunged a torch of dried grass into the ashes of the watchfire. It burst into bright flames, and after the utter blackness, the orange light seemed bright as noonday. The huge humpbacked animal had dragged Fuller from his litter in a welter of blankets and clothing. It had a grip on his lower body, and Robin heard the sharp crack of bone splintering in those terrible jaws. The sound maddened her, and she snatched up an axe that lay beside the pile of firewood and struck out at the dark, misshapen body, feeling the axe strike solidly, and the hyena let out a choking howl. The darkness and its own starvation had emboldened it. It had the taste in its mouth now, seeping through the blankets into its locked jaws, and it would not relinquish its prey. It turned and snapped at Robin, its huge round eyes glowing yellow in the light of the flames, and those terrible yellowed fangs clashing like the snap of a steel man-trap, closing on the axe handle inches from her fingers, jerking it out of her hand. Then it turned back to its prey, and once more locked its jaws onto the frail body. Fuller was so wasted that he was light as a child, and the hyena dragged him swiftly towards the opening in the thorn scarum. Still screaming for help, Robin stumbled after them and seized her father's shoulders, while the hyena had him by the belly. The woman and the animal fought over him, the blunted yellow teeth ripping and tearing through the lining of Fuller's belly as the hyena strained back on its hindquarters, the neck stretched out at the pull. The Hottentot corporal, dressed only in unlaced breeches, but brandishing his musket, ran towards them in the firelight. "Help me!" screamed Robin. The hyena had reached the thorn fence. Her feet were slipping in the loose dust. She was not able to hold Fuller. "Don't shoot! Don't shoot!" Robin screamed. The danger from the musket was as great as from the animal. The corporal ran forward, reversing the musket, and swung the butt at the hyena's head. It struck with a sharp crack of wood on bone, and the hyena released its grip. Finally, its natural cowardice overcame its greed. It turned and shambled through the opening in the thorn hedge and disappeared into the night. "O sweet, merciful God," Robin whispered, as they carried Fuller back to the litter, "has he not suffered enough?" Fuller Ballantyne lived out that night. But an hour after dawn, that tenacious and tough old man at last relinquished his grip on life without having regained consciousness. It was as though a legend had passed, and an age had died with him. It left Robin feeling numbed and disbelieving, and she washed and dressed the frail and rotting husk for burial. She buried him at the foot of a tall makusi tree, and carved into the bark with her own hand, "Fuller Maurice Ballantyne, 3rd of November 1788, the 17th of October 1860. In those days, there were giants upon the earth." She wished that she had been able to cut the words in marble. She wished that she had been able to embalm his body and carry it back to rest where it belonged, in the great abbey of Westminster. She wished that he had recognized and known who she was just once before he died. She wished she had been able to allay his suffering, and she was consumed with grief and guilt. For 3 days she maintained the camp astride the hyena road, and she spent those days sitting listlessly beside the mound of newly turned earth under the makusi tree. She drove old Karunga and even little Juba away, for she needed to be alone. On the third day, she knelt beside the grave, and she spoke aloud. "I make an oath to your memory, my dear father, I swear that I will devote my entire life to this land and its people, just as you did before me." Then she rose to her feet, and her jawline hardened. The time for mourning was past. Now her duty lay plain before her, to follow this hyena road to the sea, and then to bear witness before all the world against the monsters who used it. When the lions are hunting, the prey animals seem able to sense it. They are seized by a restlessness and will graze for only seconds at a time before throwing up their horned heads and freezing into that peculiar antelope stillness, only the wide trumpet-shaped ears moving incessantly. Then, skittering like thrown dice, they rearrange themselves upon the grassy plains, snorting and nervous, aware of danger, but uncertain of its exact source. Old Karanga had the same instinct bred into him, for he was Mashona, an eater of dirt, and as such he was natural prey. He was the first to become aware that there were Matabili somewhere close at hand. He became silent, nervous, and watchful, and it infected the other bearers. Robin saw him pick a broken ostrich plume from the grass beside the path and study it gravely, puckering his lips and hissing quietly to himself. It had not fallen from the wing of a bird. That night he voiced his fears to Robin.
"They are here, the stabbers of women, the abductors of children."
He spat into the fire with a bravado that was hollow as a dead tree trunk. "You are under my protection," Robin told him. "You and all the people in this caravan." But when they met the Matabili war party, it was without further warning, in the dawn, when the Matabili always attack. Suddenly they were there, surrounding the camp, a solid phalanx of dappled shields and nodding plumes, the blades of the broad stabbing assegai catching the early light. Old Karanga had gone in the night, and with him had gone all the other porters and bearers. Except for the Hottentots, the camp was deserted. Karanga's warning had not been in vain, however, and behind the thorn skerm, all the Hottentot guards were standing to their muskets with their bayonets fixed. The encircling Matabili stood silent, and still as statues carved from black marble. There seemed to be thousands upon thousands of them, though common sense told Robin that it was merely a trick of her heated imagination and the poor light. 100, at the most 200, she decided. Beside her, Juba whispered,
"We are safe, Nomuza. We are beyond the burnt land, beyond the border of my people. They will not kill us."
Robin wished she was as confident, and she shivered briefly, not merely from the dawn chill.
"See, Nomuza," Juba insisted, "the baggage boys are with them, and many of the Amadoda carry their isibamu, firearms. If they intended to fight, they would not so burden themselves."
Robin saw that the girl was right. Some of the warriors had rusty trade muskets slung upon their shoulders, and she remembered from her grandfather's writings that whenever the Matabili intended serious fighting, they handed their muskets, which they neither trusted nor used with any accuracy, to the baggage boys and relied entirely upon the weapon that their ancestors had forged and perfected, the assegai of Shaka Zulu.
"The baggage boys carry trade goods. They are a trading party," Juba whispered.
The baggage boys were the young apprentice warriors, and beyond the ranks of fighting men, they were still in column. As soon as Robin recognized the boxes and bundles that the baggage boys carried balanced on their heads, her last qualms faded to be replaced by anger.